This is an interview for the Avon Heathcote Estuary Ehutai Trust Oral History Project. Today is the 5th of June 2009. The interviewer is Michelle Bradley. The equipment being used is a Fostex digital field recorder and two lapel microphones. Today the interviewee is Les Batchelor. The interview is being recorded at 182 C Rocking Horse Road, South Shore, Christchurch, at the dining table of Les and Dorothy's home. This is the second interview session.
Actually, the third.
This is the second recorded interview session.
Oh, okay, second recorded. Fine.
And we've had a cup of tea and every other possible bodily need has been met, and we're about to make a start. When I interviewed you in the last session, we focused on your early life and your years of work for forestry, and very briefly on the work that you did after that. And in the session today, I'd like to ask you about living at South Brighton, your experiences in and around the estuary, and your work at and involved with the care of the estuary and various other topics associated with that.
Incidentally, it's not South Brighton, it's South Shore.
South Shore. Where does one stop and one start?
Caspian Street.
Caspian Street.
Yeah. It's just a form of local snobbery.
Now, I'd like to just take time, a time of reference, and that would be 1968, you coming to live in Christchurch.
Yep.
Had you previously spent time in Christchurch and been to the estuary before that?
Never been involved in the estuary at any degree whatever.
But now, you said to me when I met with you before recording, that you had started sailing here when you came to live in Christchurch with your son.
That's correct, yep. I had built a dinghy, and we potted with that dinghy, and then I bought a Moth, which was an international class of sailboat, a racing sailboat. Sailed that for a while, and then decided to upstage it to a catamaran. So I bought a paper tiger, and that's when I really started flogging the estuary.
Now that was with your son, your eldest son, that you...
Yeah, for a while, but then he joined the Navy and departed for places further afield.
So what sort of, about what age were you when you started? Was that competitive sailing within the club?
Oh, very competitive. I was near enough 60, yeah.
And how did you find that experience?
Oh, exhilarating. Occasionally frightening, as fast sailing always is. You know, when you're doing about 25 knots under sail, it can get a bit hair-raising. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. But it was that experience. just familiarity with the estuary, familiarity with the club, and familiarity with sailing that has put me here where I am today. In the sense that legend was coming across from older sailors, more experienced ones, that we were getting more and more problem with sea lettuce, which was getting caught up on the centreboards and rudders. It was a nuisance, to put it mildly. Now, that sea lettuce difficulty tracked back straight away to ammonia. The growth rate of sea lettuce was associated with the growth of ammonia. And after I was involved in that, quite a long time after I was involved, I was involved in the committees arguing the resource consent for the city council. And
Committee was that?
Sorry?
Which committee?
Just public respondents, but I represented the Estuary Association.
C- Could you tell me the name of the yacht club?
Mount Pleasant. Mount Pleasant Yacht Club.
The Mount Pleasant Yacht Club.
Yep. So, I had got myself involved. And by that time, of course, I'd worked out, or deduced from what I was hearing at the club, that one of the principal causes of sea lettuce was ammonia. Ergo, ammonia is a problem. The second string to that bow was then becoming involved with people who were fishing in the estuary, and knowing of the rapid decline in numbers of fish, and reading up the international literature on the subject, to which I was alerted by Dr. Wally Clark, ammonia is lethal to fish. Ergo, ammonia is a problem. So there was two angles at which I was approaching the whole business of the role of ammonia, or the significance of ammonia. I put this together, and by this time...
What did you put together, Liz?
That ammonia was a critical problem for the estuary. By this time, of course, the Estuary Association was well involved with Environment Canterbury.
Now, is this the combined Estuary Association?
Correct.
The combined Estuary Association.
Yep.
So, were you as an...
That's a new name. That's the formal name was Christchurch Estuary Association.
So the association that the chap Wright was...
Keith Wright.
Yes.
It wasn't formally... That wasn't a formal name.
Okay.
The combined.
Okay.
No. It was just the Estuary Association. What point was I going to make there?
You went on to say that you'd come to this conclusion about the problem of the ammonia, and also the fact that the Estuary Association was going to be making it known that they had concerns about what was happening in the estuary.
By that time, Environment Canterbury were taking steps to ensure that the Resource Management Act was complied with. And
so this is about the early 1990s?
Late 1990s. 1997, 1998. And they asked us, as the Estuary Association, if we had any volunteers who would assist in sampling the water in the estuary. We had 11 stations identified. I, for one, said yes. And then I went round the association and got quite a number of others. And so the Estuary Association became the right-hand servant of Environment Canterbury in sampling.
Could I just ask who initiated the sampling? Did the Regional Council respond to the ammonia issue?
Yes.
And so then they...
They had a broader statutory... reason for sampling ammonia, metals, bacteria, total environmental health stuff. With regard to the use and the classification of the estuary as recreational water for swimming. Now, for that reason, the sampling was established for the period November to the end of February, our swimming season, and that's how and when we got involved. So we just used to trot out there, and I've done it up till this summer. Go out at high tide, about an hour after high tide, and take a sample and dispatch that to Environment Canterbury, and they gave us the results of the analyses, and I poked around with them with the computer, and sorted out what I could really analyse what I could find out from that rather crude analysis, but it turned out to be quite interesting.
And your findings?
Found that from 19, 1999, the concentration of ammonia has gone down quite markedly. Now that's in the estuary. The city council, who of course run the sewage treatment plant, they had never been interested in the estuary. It was just terra incognita to them. They were more concerned with complying with the law under the Resource Management Act for the standard of effluent that they were discharging. Understandable. So we were approaching the problem from the opposite ends. But we got together and started arguing and talking about what we were finding out. So I think our submissions became respected, and we get along well with them. Yeah.
Now, I recall you saying that you attended the process around the early 1990s where the City Council were looking to renew their rights to put effluent in the estuary.
Yes, yes.
So that was
late 1990s.
91, 92?
No, later than that. It was 1996 that started.
What was that experience?
The Resource Management Act was passed, or the Revised Act, was passed in 1991. And it was a requirement of the Act that all existing consents should be re-examined within 10 years. And that's what brought the timeline through to 2001. So we basically got ourselves organised for that timetable. Now the City Council organised hearings, and I mentioned them briefly the other day. First at City Council offices, and then at the Copthorne Hotel. And while they expected, with something of a show of arrogant confidence, that this would be all over in a couple of days, it went on for, I think it was 17 days of hearings. I sat there for every minute of it, apart from 1 hour in which I ducked out to get a paper printed. And it was quite interesting. There were very good commissioners. There were four of them. So that fact alone indicated that the City Council was taking it quite seriously. Dr. Ed Whaley, a very clever lawyer, he was the chairman. Then Jim Bradley, a sewage treatment engineer from Dunedin. Then Mrs. Roima Raupata, a Maori woman from Wellington. And forgive me, but I've forgotten the name of the Australian contributor. But there were four commissioners, and that was a lot. You know, they took it seriously. And so we ground our way through all these hearings, and then the result was that we won. The commissioners decided that we had won the day.
And was that through your presentation of in defence of the estuary and the things associated?
That was. We started to put the defence of the estuary together after we finished that.
Oh, so yeah. The submissions that you made at that time were previous to...
They were compelling.
And the presenters were yourself?
Yeah, oh yes. Yes,
of
yes.
Evidence? And who else gave evidence that added to the case?
O'Connor, Clark, Hanson, Bernie Hanson, Alec Drysdale, he was there, Chrissy Williams. They weren't arguing our case, though, not at that sort of stage. Vivian Burrows. Yeah.
So I am not fully understanding of these people made contributions at that time at those hearings, and then you went on to put that in defence of the estuary. Was there in the defence of the estuary a representation of your evidence, or was it for another purpose?
Oh no! It was an attempt to objectively summarise what came out of it.
Ah.
Yeah. Now as you'll have seen from the attributes, it was written by Kevin O'Connor and myself. We put a lot of work into it.
Now, you had told me that you had got yourselves organised for those hearings and that there was quite a process about how you met. Can you take me back to that experience? To, you mentioned to me that Ruth Dyson, out of the blue, gave you a call. Had you met Ruth Dyson somewhere, or was completely out of the blue?
I knew Ruth just generally. I just knew her in the patch. And it was to my surprise that we got this letter from Ruth inviting us to make use of her party rooms in Ferry Road. It was quite a shock. Anyway, responded to it, and I put an ad in the paper, went along and just sort of sat there like a fly on the wall to see what would happen.
But you ran the meeting?
Ultimately, yes.
But when you say, was there already some organisation prior to that Ferry Road meeting?
No.
No, so...
No, no, we were meeting as an adjunct to the Estuary Association.
I was very chairman, informally.
Yeah, very informally. And I think I made the remark there yesterday or whatever, sitting there waiting, watching and seeing who was coming in the door. And I was stunned. It was all these bright buggers. And I made the remark to you that we got it hammered out, and I realised that with people like O'Connor, Clark, Burroughs, and Hanson and all those people, they were prominent people, far more prominent than I was. And but as the chairman of the Estuary Association, I thought, well, I've got to chair this, and it's going to be like herding cats. And it was. They were very hard people to hold down, but they were all very capable people. Oh, one I've forgotten there was Ian Wood, Dr. Ian Wood, who's an engineer. Are you having trouble with the surface?
No, it's all right. Yeah. I wondered if you would explain, you explained to me your explanation of why there was that concentration of ammonia.
Urine decomposes into ammonia. It is just that simple. And that was coming out with the sewage effluent, with the discharge into the estuary.
You described that concentration of it, where it was coming out in, I can't remember which part of the tide, but there was a very strong concentration of it coming, and I guess that made the evidence more prominent. Is that a fair assessment?
That's a fair assessment.
If you could just talk a bit more about that. I know you've explained it to me already.
That's all right. It was exacerbated by a understandable but quite erroneous management decision. Professor George Knox was the last speaker to contribute to the hearings. In fact, they suspended the meetings for about 3 weeks while he was still overseas, and then reconvened when he got back. Now, George just simply said that the discharge on the ebb tide was decided upon as a result of research done by himself and Ian Kilner, K-I-L-L-N-E-R. And this trickle was quite the wrong thing to do. You should shoot it out quick. Intuitively, it looked quite sensible. But it did mean that there was a high concentration slug went out, and that's what paid to the fish. So it was a nice idea, but it was wrong. And of course, it took a half a dozen years to pick that up.
And what sort of evidence did you see other than the sea lettuce and the presentations of people becoming unwell or sailing? You also mentioned to me that you saw very good evidence in the fish.
Oh, the fish disappeared. It's interesting that Peter Neal, chap just down the road, he brought his family to New Zealand in 1970. And when they got their bearings, and using their East Anglian fishing skills, they discovered that there were a lot of can you stop that for a moment? You're just going to be
if I stop it, I have to start it. Start again. Was it shrimp?
Shrimps, thank you. There were a lot of shrimps in the estuary. Now that was 1970, and they started fishing, I think, in 71. By 1974, there were no shrimps. They just disappeared. The disappearance of the bony fish and the disappearance of the shrimps, you could only reasonably attribute that to the slug of ammonia that was going down there on the ebb tide, which the experts had recommended that they do. So it was the wrong thing to do for good reasons, but that finished the fish populations off. Yeah.
Do you think maybe that the very clear evidence that came through the slug may have helped with the turn of attitudes? That if it had just been trickled out, that the evidence wouldn't have been so compelling?
Oh, I entirely agree. They proved the case against themselves. Yes. But it's a very good reminder in natural history. How do you collect definitive evidence? It was a nice idea, but it happened to be wrong.
Now, is there anything else that you'd like to mention about the water sampling as far as what has come out of that process? You see that the ammonia levels are much lower, is it?
Ammonia is trending down. And we've got good statistical evidence that it is trending down. That wasn't known just 5 years ago, you know. How do you analyse a statistic from the sampling of something like seawater collected in minute quantities? You know, they are really minute. They're just little pottles. And I figured out a method of doing it. It's a pain in the neck, but we got there, and we just simply we set it all up on a PC, and there was, I think it was 10,000 numbers, which Dorothy and I patiently plugged into the computer, and then ran the average, and then to my amazement we saw this progressive decline. Nobody had figured or suspected that we would be able to get that evidence that way, nor that it would be mathematically significant, but it was very significant. It was 40% decline. Yeah.
Any other outcomes from the interpretation other than
not really. I didn't look for anything else. That's what I was after.
You also mentioned to me that it was really with the cooperation of the City Council in part that helped with that process, as far as you mentioned Mike Burke.
Oh, Mike was very helpful. He was stung by some of the things that happened, and I understand that. He was the manager of the plant that was doing this terrible job, but they had a job to do. You know, we had 300,000 people pooping in every morning and urinating and leaving a mess for them to clean up. And if anything goes wrong, they get it in the neck. It's a no-win situation for Mike. And I think he was grateful that we talked and we reported, but we never hounded him with stinging criticism. We said, what can we do about it? And so we were in a joint council. One of the outcomes, more in the last 2 years than up to then, a fellow by the name of Chris Bathurst, Dr. Chris Bathurst, he came on board with us, and Chris realised and dealt very intelligently with the data that this was a very good source of fuel, or biofuel.
And so, what was Les?
Oh, the effluent.
Ah. prior to it coming into the estuary?
Yeah. So they have spent quite a lot of money sorting out a method of extracting the biofuel, in fact synthesising it, that the city council knew a lot about that, of course, and they were burning ammonia from the plant, digesting ammonia for quite some years. The digest was going up in flames, and we were burning that, and Christchurch Public Hospital, Burwood Hospital, was completely powered by Bromley. And that's a good thing.
And is Chris an employee?
No, he's a private contractor, a private consultant.
Now, we've had a little bit of talking about the hearings for the City Council process for renewal, and you say that the case for it not to be renewed was successful. So what was the outcome?
The pipeline is just about ready.
But it wasn't, at the conclusion of the hearing. So what was the process that led to that, as you recall?
That was the outcome. The City Council was given 5 years. They just couldn't turn the tap off. So the Commission gave them a five-year breathing space to organise some alternative. They did not declare what the alternative should be. That was not their task. Right? So the City Council had 5 years to think it out, and that's where the pipeline proposal came from. They were first going to take the effluent through in a parallel-sided steel drain, you know. Now, there's a lot of unhappy people about that, because it would just stunk like anything, and would be so overtly obvious, and would have gone straight down the middle of somebody's street. I actually don't know who realised that there was some experience from overseas in micro-tunnelling, where they just go in and bore a tunnel and just push it out that way. But anyway, they caught on to it, they took it up, and the contractor got the job.
And there was quite a preceding process. There was the wastewater working party,
yes,
after the hearings.
Yes.
And I believe that the City Council was still slow to be cooperative, let's say.
Not really.
No?
No, so oh, no. They just had to approach everything from a different angle. We could sit and slag and criticise, but they had to actually implement.
So you were part of that group?
Yep.
And was that a small or a large group?
Oh, about 15, I think.
And was one of your conclusions the ocean outfall pipeline?
That was what my preference from a long way back. I did a lot of calculating when we were trying to get a decision out of the working party. What do you do with 1.5 million cubic metres of effluent per day? What do you do with it? And I was keen to see it used for agriculture, going out past Bottle Lake, out toward the Waimak. We could use a lot of it on there, but further back up the plains. But the costs of reticulation would have been stupendous. It had been estimated something like 300 million. And it was for that reason that we said, what about piping it to the ocean? And that initially was estimated at 42 million, and so that became the favoured option. So everybody just went along with it, go to the ocean by pipeline.
What about the Maori representatives on that?
They acknowledged the inevitable, that we had to do it. They were certainly not obstructive.
And you had representatives in that group?
Ngāi Tahu, yeah, they had representatives, two. Rakahia Tau, Rick Tau, and Elizabeth Cunningham, both of them, and very good people, very good people. So they knew fully well that it was their effluent that was going out to
And how has the project proceeded for people in South Brighton and South Shore?
Very well. We have an audit group that meets around about every 3 or 4 months. And we've met at South Brighton, go and have a chat, just how things are going. Mention anything that we're not happy about. Listen to the engineers. There's been absolutely no quarrelling or disharmony at all. It's gone very well. Once the decision was taken, we've all found the city council people very good. We're just banging their heads against the wall. It took the time.
Now, the Estuary Association, does that continue as an organisation?
I think that's in abeyance at the moment. I don't think it should. We went to a lot of trouble to set up the trust. And the trust has the tremendous advantage that they are being funded by the City Council. The Estuary Association was never funded on anything. Now that means that the trust can hire students to do studies and we can reimburse them. And it's good, it's good. So I don't think the estuary is big enough for two organisations. It's quite simple. I think we should fold our tent and melt away. But some of the people in the Estuary Association love the exposure and the public profile that's with it. And so they want to keep going. Now, I'm not going to name them.
So that they do meet from time to time. They continue to meet time to time.
Yeah, we've had a hiatus for a couple of months where our chairman and his wife have been overseas. They've been flogging up the Nile Valley, looking at the ancient treasures of Egypt.
And the chairman, the current chairman?
So the current chairman is Murray Sim.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And you took the role of chairman for a number of years.
Oh, yes, about 10 years. Yeah.
Can you recall that period of time? What
do I recall it?
No, I mean the date as far
can,
as...
Can I date it? About 1998 to 2003 or something like that. About that. Yeah.
So quite a significant time with all the other events.
Oh, yeah.
So can you give me an account of your recollection of the formation of the Avon Heathcote Estuary Ehutai Trust?
Well, I should be able to, because it was me that was bullying them to form it. I realised that we had to have a broad-based, supported association arguing the public case. Because there's no question in my mind that when public servants, and I was one, long enough, get an authority, they tend to play it close and exclude the public from consideration. And that was happening here, no question. So anyway...
What would be an example of that?
The fact that they never even acknowledged or understood that ammonia was a problem. It, you know, who cares? It's just ammonia. But when you sat back and looked at it, you could see the death of fish and the increased nitrogen content of the ecosystem. It was obvious, ecologically it was obvious there was a problem, but the administrators didn't want to admit it. The public management model is not a good one for solving problems. And I think I understand that too. If I was a politician, I'd say, get off my bloody patch.
So I interrupted you.
That's no worries. Yeah. But as always happens, there's one or two councillors in the mix who say, hey, shouldn't we be listening to them? You know? And it was that in this case. There's a couple there. I'm not going to name them.
So you came to this realisation that to make the management of the estuary more robust, let's say, that the idea of a trust, of a new organisation.
Yes. Principally, that it was able to be funded, and it had a mechanism for handling that funding, and access to expertise which it could hire to carry out studies. And we have one particular woman in the zoology department, Ida Marsden, and she's got a marvellous ability to dredge up students who need a subject thesis with payment, of course. And so we're getting some good information accumulating about the estuary. There was some available before, but it certainly accelerated under Isla's management. It's going well.
That was an ambitious plan, really, though.
It was.
So what were the events that resulted in the formation of the trust? The idea, and then subsequent to that, there was
dissatisfaction with the status quo.
And who facilitated, were there public meetings? Did the City Council come into agreement early on? And on the suggestion?
I'm a bit of a big head here, but I think I could contribute quite a lot. I know I did. But I remember first going along to a committee meeting of city councillors. And
a committee for?
Just an ad hoc committee of city councillors who were meeting in Tuam Street one night. And I went along and sort of sat in the background and thought, this is just bloody nonsense, I'm not getting anywhere. And so I waded in, and I became centre stage very quickly. And we put a few points, and the city councillors, or those people, recognised that it had to change. We had to do something. And it was a question of collaboration, not competition, but collaboration. So, yeah, I'm delighted when I look back at what came out of it. But I know there were some people who got stung. Dennis O'Rourke was one who got stung. He was quite opposed to any external criticism or scrutiny. But he came round in the finish. It was a change of management style, you know.
But it took some time for the trust to form?
Oh, yeah, it took about 5 years. Yeah.
And so that was a series of consultations and
meetings, yeah. Head bashing meeting.
and then you decided upon a core group, or a core group was formed, and had the memorandum of understanding.
That was the Estuary Association wrote the MOU, memorandum of understanding, and. Actually, there was a subcommittee met up at the South Brighton Surf Life Saving Club, Yacht Club. Pleasant Point Yacht Club, I'm sorry. Mm. Chrissy Williams was a member of that, and two or three other women and old blokes, Alec Drysdale. And we sort of thrashed out what we were trying to achieve. And that put a lot of stuff on the table, and we realised that there was only one format that would manage it, and that was if we formed a trust to give it legal protection, give the people legal protection, and gave them access to funding from the City Council. So it took about 6 months to argue it through, but that was what came out of it, and the trust was what resulted.
And you met with the Regional Council and the City Council and shaped it with them a bit as well, I guess.
Yes, correct. Yep.
And then decided...
Sorry, be careful. We never met with the City Council in a formal sense as a body, no. We met with the Regional Council in a formal sense as a body. I don't know why that difference, but by then the City Councillors were well indoctrinated. Most of them understood what we were getting at, and most of them went along. Yeah.
And then
I can remember coming out of a meeting after bashing our heads And we published In Defence of the Estuary, O'Connor and I. And one of the councillors, I'll tell you his name if I can remember it, but he had to go away for a couple of months. He wasn't going to be at the next meeting. So he said, Mr. Chairman, there is one thing I would like to say to summarise all these discussions, is that as I read in the paper from the Estuary Association, the solution to pollution is dilution, which was just a little catchphrase that we'd popped in. I never thought that would be worth a thing, but that became the key point. Dilution is the solution to pollution. How true.
And I guess there was a bit more fun had than that at times as well.
It got pretty bloody at times. But no, it was pretty good. It was pretty civil.
So the committee was formed and a chairman duly elected.
Committee of what?
From the trust.
Of the trust. Yes, and that was Alec Drysdale, and he's still chairman. I think he loves chairing. He's a good one too.
We've moved a little bit around in my format, but that's absolutely fine. So I'll just stay with asking questions about the trust and their more current considerations.
I don't want to get into too much on the...
Any question that you don't want to answer is fine. So, but I'm sure that they're not hard-edged questions. I'm just interested to know that when I read about the trust and meeting with the trust, it strikes me as a very good example of democracy.
Of?
Democracy.
That's what it's designed to do.
And so I wondered if in reality, how well they've managed that as in the inner group, let's say.
It's a bigger group, and it is funded by the City Council. Now that is its strength and its weakness, because it exposes people to corruption, that if they do something, they'll get paid by the City Council. Now there have been three or four examples of that. I'm not going to name them, but it's happened, and it's a great disappointment to me that people have to take money for the public service. But they're in different positions than I. You know, I had luck to be on a salary for a long, long time. Others have not been in that situation. But they've done a good job.
So you'd identify that as a weakness?
Oh, definitely.
And the strength being that
there's an old phrase in the language that he who pays the piper called the tune. And that has happened.
Do you think that the integrated environmental management approach is useful and
oh yes, it's a buzzword, but once it becomes understood and acted on, of course, then that's another level of integrated management. But don't think that there was no management before that phrase was coined. There was some very good management. Some of the best management in the Forest Service was long before that phrase came out.
So a different model?
Yeah. We chopped all the bloody remu down. We had to grow something in its place. And we had a department that was adamant about doing it and did it very well. But then Helen Clark threw them out with the bathwater.
There seems to be quite a number of local and central government and various quasi-government organisations who, and probably private contractors, who have some finger in the pie of what happens in and around the estuary. I'm just wondering how well the Trust is doing in keeping in communication and garnering support and cooperation with these.
I'm not going to try to say that I know. I'm losing track of it. I am losing interest in it. There are a lot of fins in the water. For historical and legal reasons, you know, the Fisheries Act, marine legislation, coastal legislation, terrestrial legislation, local body legislation, they are all inevitably in the pie. And they get along. Put it this way, if the discussion is, are they doing the right thing, I say, on the whole, yes.
Well, I think that's a very good answer.
Thank you.
What about the... There's two review processes that I'm aware of this year. There's probably lots of others out as well, but the Resource Management Act, is that something that you have any view on?
Yeah, I do, but it's irrelevant. The principal point I would make is that the thrust for the review of the Resource Management Act is to put more and more pylons across farmers' paddocks to service bloody Auckland, to get more and more electricity into Auckland. That's what it's all about. There's nothing else matters a toss to the good burghers of Auckland except for uninterrupted, absolutely abundant supply of electricity coming to the north from the south.
So would you hope that there would be some people who had the energy to speak out about that?
Oh, yeah. But they won't get anywhere. The business is against them. Remember when the lights went out in Auckland a couple of years ago? That scared the shit out of them.
What about the review of the trust? Well, it's just a review of their management plan. Have you made any assessment of the management plan as a working document?
Well, the management plan is really the facilitation plan. You know, facilitating other people to do it, like students. And for an amateur volunteer body, it's not a bad model.
What do you consider to be the high point of your involvement with the Estuary, where you were the chairman of the Estuary Association? What do you think were there high points of? Do you think you've already covered it in the answers that you've given?
I think the high point of my involvement with this estuary has been the decision to go ahead with the pipeline. It's the most important thing that's happened since 1889.
Can you explain that a little bit further?
All right. In the late 1880s, the effluent from Christchurch Hospital was just dumped into the Avon. That was bacteria, viruses, you name it. The disease rate was stupendous. Christchurch's effluent was just taken by bucket, the old night cart, and dumped into pits just out the back of the square. We forget this. And it stunk. Christchurch stunk. And it was in the late 1880s that some perceptive councillor could see, hey, we've got to break this. And that's when they first put a pipeline down Armagh Street. And it went into the paddocks just at the back of the Linwood, just on the other side of the estuary. And then they forgot it. They thought, well, that's solved it, doesn't matter. Can't do any damage. And they had a very good system, but, you know, it stunk like hell. If you went for a bike ride through from the Ferrymead Bridge to New Brighton and up through the ponds, it was odoriferous, to say the least. But it worked. But there was an absolute blind spot. The people, the engineers and the public had no idea that effluent, which was going into soak pits and going into the ground, was in fact shooting straight through the sand into the estuary. It was just disappeared. But the first biological survey of the estuary was done in 1929. Sea lettuce was not even mentioned. It just didn't exist. It was mentioned. It said there are some minor traces of sea lettuce near some of the rock outcrops. That was the comment on sea letters, 1929. By 1950, the place was stinking with sea letters. And the professional biologists were then starting to realise, hey, something's happening here, you know. They negotiated a resource consent for estuary discharge to build Bromley, to build the new works, in 1962, I think it was. And they asked for a resource consent of 33 years. 1962 and 33 is 1995. Now, the lawyer who applied for that consent on behalf of the City Council was Anthony Hearn. And he told us in 1999, I think it was, that having been given that consent in 1962, it should persist in perpetuity. In other words, close this down, you're wasting your bloody time, we're going to continue discharging forever into the estuary. That's when I blew my stack. I really did. And I called him a stupid old bastard in the public foyer in the Copthorne Hotel. You pull your head out of the bloody sand, Anthony. And he was so upset at my attitude. But he was being outrageous, you know, that we have a God-given right to shit in your swimming hole forever. That's what he basically was saying. I said, you haven't, mate, we'll fight it. And that's why the consent hearings were so animated. And I think that's why I got a lot of support from O'Connor and Wood and Clark and Burroughs and all those redoubtable people. They were the brains. They were the brains. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. Anyway, it was a lot of fun.
You're continuing with the water quality samples for a number of more years?
I have promised myself that, God willing, I will carry on for another 2 years. I want to do a full 10 years. Myself, so that I can prove that we did it for 10 years. Yeah.
What do you hope to see at the end of the 10 years?
Further decline in concentration of ammonia, yeah. and bacteria. Yeah.
Will the sampling continue beyond what you're hoping to do?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know?
No. That's in the lap of the gods.
Oh, that's all right. I've got a final question and we'll take a break. It's a contemplative question. What do you imagine that your great-grandchildren might experience when they visit the estuary, say in 2020? Or what would you hope that they might experience?
2020, my grandchildren.
Great-grandchildren.
Great-grandchildren. Well, they'll be swimming. Those kids will be swimming in the estuary. And sailing, and regarding it as a beautiful place to swim and recreate. Yeah. That's what I look forward to. It becomes a treasure. The jewel in the crown of Christchurch. Is that suitably pompous?
Wonderfully so. I couldn't have written a better ending myself. Would you like to make any further comment?
No, just get it cleaned up. The city can afford it, or our community can afford it. It deserves it. It's timely. We could technically do it. Let's bloody do it. That's my feeling.
Thanks, Les. As I said, we'll take a breather now.
Jolly good. Well, I'll go and get the boss. She can organise some lunch.